Take a network break. Welcome to episode 62. Grab a coffee and a virtual donut and join us for an analysis of the latest IT news, vendor moves, and new product announcements. We'll separate the signal from the noise, or at least make some noise of our own. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow, coming to you live from 100 megabits per second bandwidth.
I'm back on the internet. Hey, no more 3G or a busted down 1 meg DSL connection that drops about 20 to 30% of packets on any given day. It's been horrible. But just do simple things like surfing the web has been slow and painful.
Well, welcome back to the land of the living.
Mm.
Our sponsor this week is Riverbed. Your work, your business, your productivity, they all depend on the performance of your application. So let Riverbed accelerate your software-driven enterprise. Thanks, Riverbed, for being a sponsor. And let's jump right into the news. Of course, the big story for the week, Cisco and Ericsson teaming up to form a new super partnership.
Boom, right?
Boom. Hey.
Boom. Just, you know, boom, out of nowhere. Sideswipe the entire industry. Nobody knew. There was no scuttlebutt. And apparently, when you figure that they've been talking for more than a year, is what Chuck Robbins said, that's pretty amazing that nobody has let any scuttlebutt out of the bag.
It kept the lid on that pretty tight.
Depending on who you read and what you think about, this is a reaction to the service provider industry. It's got very little to do with the enterprise market in any way.
Right. This does seem like a service provider motivated move. And let's just quickly go over the details and then we can get into all the analysis. Mm-hmm. So what supposedly this partnership is going to entail is that Cisco and Ericsson will do a reference architecture. They'll do joint developments. There are reseller agreements. They'll collaborate. There's also some licensing issues going on. I guess Ericsson is going to get some licensing fees. Maybe Cisco and Ericsson have been doing some IP tussling. So they've decided to clear the decks of that. And supposedly, they're predicting that each company is going to pull in as much as $1 billion in revenue by 2018.
Which is phenomenal.
That seems a little blue sky to me, but who knows?
Well, I guess there's several different parts about this, is that while we're watching HP split into pieces to get smaller and become more nimble, Dell and EMC are merging to get bigger and to have scale.
Hmm?
Cisco and Ericsson are merging to get scale, but without going through the two-year-long process of, you know, going to the markets, getting approval, shareholder approval, legals, lawyers, financing, da-da-da-da.
Cultural integration, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. So there's this quote from John Chambers here in somewhere I found it. Unfortunately, I forgot. I lost the reference, so I apologize. This industry will be won and lost in the next 3 years. So it's all about speed and how you go about it. While we're a huge believer in big to small and big to medium acquisitions, partnerships, if you can do them, are the way to go large to large. Joint ventures add an extra level of complexity. You have an overriding group, a board, and that slows you down. So what he's alluding to there is that Dell EMC is going to take at least a year to get approval, and then it will take a year to go through the first phase of the merger of Dell and EMC. Last week or the week before, we saw the split of Hewlett-Packard into HP Inc. and HP Enterprise. And the split there, that's a year in the making. It literally started 14 months ago.
That's right.
Finally, it's been executed on. Now the split's happened. There's still another year of disruption as they get through and stabilize. And what John Chambers is trying to tell people is that the market will be over in 3 years. So if you spend 2 years of it buying Ericsson, you're not going to be out front.
He is never one to shy away from bold pronouncements. He's very good at that.
He's very good at saying whatever is convenient for the moment and repeating the same thing over and over. So,
well, in 6 years, if he's still saying this market will be won in the next 3 years, then we can call him on it.
Well, we should put that in the spreadsheet.
That's correct. Get the magic spreadsheet.
I agree with him that the industry will go through substantial translation in the next 3 years. SDN, software-defined networking, but more importantly, network functions virtualization is hugely disruptive to carriers.
Yep.
This idea of buying hardware routers is being replaced by buying software routers that will run on x86 commodity hardware. It won't run on custom hardware that's being made by Ericsson or Cisco today. So Ericsson has their Redback. I'm not sure what it's called today. I've sort of lost track of it, but they bought Redback several years ago and have been trying to build their own IP routers, and not overly successfully. Cisco, of course, has very strong in the IP routing space. there's no overlap between the two companies. So if you look at Ericsson, they're very strong in the RAN or the radio access network. So their ability to build towers and have custom hardware to do propagate 4G and 5G coming up, that's really important. Ericsson does that. Cisco does not do that. Both companies do professional services, so there's not a lot of overlap in the service provider market in the sense that Ericsson's doing the RAN, Cisco's doing the WAN, the wired access network, not the wide area network. And so there is room for a partnership, but the question is, can a joint venture work? In the past, we've seen very, very few joint ventures succeed. In fact, any joint ventures that I've seen Cisco participate in recent history have all died sad, miserable deaths. So VCE, for example, IBM and Cisco, you know, the list goes on and on. Yeah, you really would struggle to say that this would last for long. You know, if you look back in history, you'd say this is just a press release. You know, Cisco never, these things never stick, they never work, it's whatever. But, you know, Chuck Robbins and the CEO of Ericsson have been very loud and proud about it. So maybe.
Well, that's what I'm surprised at the fanfare around a partnership, because partnership announcements get made all the time. And I guess I just didn't, you know, if they were collaborating on some amazing new product, I mean, I know they just rolled it out, but I guess I just don't feel like this is something I really want to wait and see on, because you can talk up a partnership to the end of the world, but you really have to start putting some actual numbers and results behind it down the road. I think I understand the pressure that these guys are under and the market opportunities they see. But as you say, these kind of joint partnerships with two huge organizations can be difficult to pull off, even as difficult as a merger in some cases.
Yes, and I can see his point. Making a merger would be infinitely complex and hard, and not necessarily, you know, not something that would be easily achieved. And there's a massive culture clash between Ericsson, a European company, and Cisco, the brash, you know, East Coast America company. So, but I think it's more important to understand the change in the competitive space in the service provider markets, and that's really what's driving this deal. The most of the analysts that I've read believe that the merger of Nokia and Alcatel-Lucent completely changes up the space. So in the RAN networking space, it's always been Nokia versus Alcatel versus Ericsson. Mm-hmm. And then there's been a couple of companies in the US like Qualcomm and stuff. We've tried to get in on that, but they've really not managed to dominate that market, because 3G won years ago. The Americans made a mistake backing the Qualcomm 2.5G and their proprietary silicon. It was a government decision. And that, in the end, the open standard 3G ended up to dominate, and the American RAN providers sort of weren't overly successful. But with Nokia and Alcatel-Lucent, what's left of Nokia, of course, the bit that doesn't make handsets and phones and all that other stuff, is absolutely a huge. So this means that Ericsson's got to get bigger or do something, and also Cisco's going to lose out, because Alcatel-Lucent pulled out of the enterprise market completely to focus on the service provider market. They sold off their Alcatel-Lucent enterprise business. Nokia got rid of their Nokia-Siemens joint venture, which was their enterprise business unit. So they are just focused on the service provider space. So that's one thing.
Yeah, and all of these organizations, of course, see Huawei coming up hard and fast in the mirror.
And Huawei is probably the big one. I think the Nokia-Alcatel merger is nowhere near as significant as Huawei, and to a lesser extent, ZTE. You may not have heard of ZTE, but in the APAC market, or the Far Eastern market, however you want to slice and dice that, Huawei and ZTE are far greater in market share than you can possibly imagine. They are winning the bulk of the deals, like for China Telecom and so forth over there. The stories I hear is that the Huawei and the ZTE products are certainly subpar. So, for example, even my personal experience with their consumer products, recently my old internet connection came with a Huawei product, and as soon as there was problems on the line, the vendor just shipped me a D-Link product to replace it.
I didn't even fight you.
No questions asked. Yes, no, there's definitely something wrong. Our first step is to replace your Huawei. And I'm like, wow. I've heard plenty of stories, you know, like the Huawei products aren't reliable or stable over the years, and that hasn't changed a bit. But they'll catch up. And the thing is that when you saving that much money, you can be tolerant of those downtimes and those problems to a greater extent. People pretend that only the best will do and it has to be absolute primo, but at the end of the day, price wins, and that's what Huawei and ZTE are winning on. And there's a number of emerging tier two service provider manufacturers coming out as well in those markets. I see this as a stop Huawei getting dominant in the European market, and to try and block them out of the Asian markets as well.
My feeling when I first heard about it was that definitely this is an attempt to kind of counter the advances that, Huawei's been making. My guess is that Asia is potentially a lost cause at this point, but they need to stop whatever business they're losing in Europe and the U.S.
Don't forget that Ericsson's been strong on NFE, like service provider NFE. They've been doing very much seen as a leader. They haven't been loud and proud about it. Like, they don't stand up in in public forums like AT&T and make grand pronouncements. They've just sort of gotten on with it. They've been very strong on the OpenStack and orchestration market, and that ability to go from a hardware-based RAN to a software-based RAN, or a virtualized EPC, or whatever you want to call it, has been key to them getting an edge here. And that works well for Cisco, because Cisco's, of course, got the UCS products, which they want to grow, which may be well-suited for service providers who perceive that they need magic features in their boxes to make them service provider ready. And UCS is full of those value-added features that customers might want to pay for. Ericsson's got the services team and the long-term history in that market that Cisco hasn't been able to penetrate. Cisco's tried to make a number of acquisitions without a whole lot of success. They've done okay, but they haven't done a whole lot of success. So maybe we'll see some tie-ups there between Cisco's Intercloud or its microservices stack. So Cisco's got its OpenStack distro. There might be something there. Be interesting to see that, to sort of keep an eye on that part of the tie-up.
So there could be potential. Do you think you mentioned that Ericsson's been strong in OpenStack and NFV? Do you think there could be that may be a sticking point if they're each trying to push their own implementation, Ericsson and Cisco?
No, I don't think so. I think the question is, will Ericsson shift to using Cisco's versions of that, or will Cisco take on Ericsson's versions of that? There is competition there in the NFV space. They might agree to use OpenStack, but will they use, I don't know, ACI, or will they use the service provider SDN strategy to link the NFV instances? Mm-hmm. Whose NFV instances will they use? What about public clouds? Or, will they use the Intercloud product to build private clouds at Ericsson? Or will they use the Intercloud product to sell to customers to say, this is your VEPC orchestration system?
Mm-hmm.
So, and Cisco's got its OpenStack distro as well, of course.
Right.
It's got a man in every corner of the market.
It's got a finger in every pie.
A finger in every pie, yeah. They don't know which one's going to win. So instead of making a decision and backing a single product, of course, it's up to the customer to make that decision. Cisco's in every single one that you think you might want to be in. Some of them, they're just in. They're not serious about, and others they're highly committed to, but it's very difficult to tell. If you think Cisco's going to advise you on the best possible solution, you're probably mistaken right now. It's up to you to make the best choice, because Cisco's playing every man on the field.
I have to imagine the folks over at Juniper are looking at this agreement with some glum faces.
Well, that's what the share market thinks. They dropped Juniper's share price by 5 to 10% because Ericsson was a major partner. And it's hard to see how Ericsson's partnership with Juniper would not suffer in some way. But again, I read an article somewhere, I think it was Light Reading, saying that they did a survey of which routing product service providers prefer, and the vast majority of that survey responses was Juniper. So maybe it will be mitigated. They'll continue to sort of buy Juniper from Ericsson in spite of Cisco being partnered. Yeah, the customer wins in every deal, right? So if the customer says, we want Juniper, then guess what Ericsson's going to sell them?
And this is the weak point of a partnership versus a merger. In a partnership, it's presumably an agreement between equals, and Ericsson or Cisco at the end of the day is going to look to their own bottom line, not necessarily to the health of the partnership. And that may be some leverage that Juniper can play.
Yes, and these partnerships very rarely work, as I said. Who gets commission? Who gets credited? Right down at the coalface, there's a whole bunch of angst. There are careers on existing strategy that are going to get derailed. But the transition has to happen. The flip side of this is that the market has been disrupted by the Alcatel-Lucent and Nokia merger. Huawei is growing in market share faster than the other guys can bash them down. The spending in the 4G market is already slowing. Mm-hmm. So there's, I think I put a link in here from Dell'Oro saying that the third quarter dropped by 10% of sales in the radio networking because carriers are now holding back on capital spending. This transition has to happen, but that doesn't mean that partnerships work just because they have to happen, because the people on the ground are revenued quarter by quarter. They only live quarter by quarter. Most salary slaves only live for month to month, to paycheck to paycheck. So anything that affects the paycheck in the next 3 months is right on their agenda.
Absolutely. And I love that expression at the coalface, because that's where these kind of partnerships will succeed or not. If you can get the folks outside, you know, out selling to actually implement these kind of partnerships, that's where it counts. The executives can say everything they want, but it's the folks whose paycheck is on the line who are making the deals in front of the customer that really matter.
Indeed. And so the fact that we're seeing the two CEOs stand up very publicly, they recorded a video. It was what I call a puppet video. That's where they sit there and spout prepared words. It's kind of, why would you even bother? But I think the doing a dog and pony show should carry some weight with the workforce. They should see that as some sort of, many people perceive that, you know, those types of people coming out with big public statements, in that sort of, see that as validation that this is actually a serious effort by both companies. So perhaps that's what they're trying to achieve here by putting their best players into this game.
Yeah, I think so. And just a quick mention of that Dell'Oro article you referenced, we'll have a link to in the show notes. And I think that also did a nice job of they've got a good chart of breaking out where Ericsson and Cisco are strong and where they're weak, and how that overlaps, and how those product categories dovetail nicely together. So check that out if you have a chance.
Yeah, the thing about Dell'Oro is that they are a numbers analyst firm. So they will go out and do surveys. They'll speak to people in the industry and try and size the capability of these. And so they're very, very well informed about that, exactly that, how much money do each company has, and, you know, per quarter and so forth. So the companies are fairly evenly matched. Cisco is the bigger partner, but not by too much.
No, these are both giants. And let's stick with some Cisco news. Cisco also dropped its quarterly financials this week.
Yeah, bad news if you're a Cisco shareholder. Last time I checked, they were down 5%. I should probably check again, I guess. But they announced results which actually were very good for the quarter, very good sales, very strong sales right across the board, general increases in the enterprise market, although some of the selling prices were off a bit. Good profits, continuing. Customers are giving them so much money that they're still making good margin and something there. But predicted the consensus, in the market was a 5% growth in Q1, in the next quarter, sorry. Cisco's got a very weird quartering system. This is the Q1 they've just announced. So next quarter is only going to be between 0 and 2% of growth. They're seeing the sales cycle slow right down, so they're going to market. Now, the consensus was 5%. Share price is down because at some point the share market tries to predict where the share is going and buy on the predicted value. Not all the value of the company is determined by that, but a significant proportion of it. So when Cisco came in with 0 to 2% growth in the next quarter, shares were sold off pretty rapidly. Or the value of the shares.
So Cisco did have a good financial quarter, the one they're reporting on. They beat expectations. They made revenue. It's the next quarter where they're taking the stock hit because they're projecting 0 to 2%, as you said, where, you know, industry was saying we want, or expecting 5%, and Cisco said, no. That's where they took the hit.
Earnings per share is still good. So if you're someone who owns the shares because you want the dividend, well, that's pretty good. You should still expect one, but, you know, the pricing's still dropping down pretty hard. They're down 5%, 5.16% now from yesterday. So from $28 down under $26.50 now and going down.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, you know, you read the rest of the results in the transcript and Cisco's done well. ACI, the general consensus is that ACI is boosting up quite nicely. The sales there have been strong. Nexus 9000 products, 3000 and 9000 are very, very strong. Very strong growth in that. It's cannibalizing the Nexus 7000s. So what's basically happening is people are buying Nexus 9000s and Nexus 3000s instead of Nexus 7000s and Nexus 5000s. Those products are, in most people's eyes, would be regarded as obsolete. They're yesterday's products, which is interesting because, you know, we've been tracking merchant silicon here at the Packet Pushers for, what, 3 years now, 2 years?
Mm-hmm. A substantial amount of time.
Yep. And, of course, Nexus 3000 and 9000 use Broadcom's merchant silicon chipset. And it looks like that's validation that the custom silicon market is handily over. Of course, what's driving people to the Nexus 9000 and 3000 is the price. Those switches are far cheaper to buy, often half the price of a Nexus 7000, or the 5500s. Far simpler and far more reliable from what I'm hearing. So anybody who's owned a Nexus 7700 or a Nexus 5000 is just nodding their head here with all the bugs and the hassles they had, by and large. Anybody who's had a widespread experience of them. And the all the stories I've heard about the 9000, 3000 is that it's a much more stable, much more reliable platform, mostly because all of the junk, that's all the legacy stuff that they tried to push into the 77, into those legacy products, is taken out. So the next generation of switching will be very simple, very passive. And of course, you need an overlay on top. Now, whether you buy Cisco's ACI or VMware's NSX or one of the other ones is up to you. But simple switching, simple hardware is the future at a cheaper price.
Uh-huh.
But that might cause Cisco a problem in the future. There's a lot of pent-up demand to buy new data center switches, I suspect. But as people buy these switches, there's a lot of money being taken off the table that's destructive to the total value selling proposition.
Well, that's something else we can keep an eye on, and we'll see what Cisco has to say for its next quarterly results. Another story, last week, around the end of the week, Reuters reported that Verizon might be selling some of its enterprise assets, the business formerly known as MCI, and then Terramark, which was its data center unit, and that launched, you know, 1,000 blogs about more disruption in the telco space and the impact of NFV and SDN. But this week, Verizon's come back and has essentially said, no, that's not happening. We don't have any plans to do that. Those are just rumors.
The rumor is that they're selling their enterprise business units at some point. One of them was their cloud, the Terramark cloud. And of course, everybody who's a cloud fanatic, you know, the cloudarati, especially Lydia Leong over at Gartner, you know, the biggest cloud booster of them all, AWS is the only cloud that thou shalt have, is pretty much her motto. But sorry, I'm just picking up off some stuff on Twitter where people were making fun of Gartner analysts again. The point is that running a cloud isn't as popular as it was. Now, nobody seems to want to say running a cloud is hard, and if you're Verizon, who actually makes an astonishing amount of money out of selling people's data. Did you read that article this week about that?
I did not, no.
There's a $24 billion market in taking, what they do is analyze all the traffic that's flowing across their backbone. So all of your data as it flows across the service provider backbone, and there's a $24 billion business selling that data to third parties.
I'm not surprised.
So telcos are actually taking, you know, and there's no opt-in there.
That's right.
Out, right?
Yeah. You're on the wire, buddy.
You're on the wire. You're hammered. So I think what we're seeing here is, one is companies who thought they were going to get into the cloud, like Verizon thought they were going to be the next AWS 3 or 4 years ago, are suddenly saying, you know, we need to get rid of those cloud assets because that's not where the future is. And, I mean, even in practical terms, AWS is sort of getting out of IaaS. They're much more into the software on top now. You know, the database as a service, the DNS as a service, load balancing as a service, mm-hmm. programming as, you know, all that sort of stuff. That's very much where they're at. The fact that you want IaaS, they want out of that business completely. Second, it's also very interesting that AWS and Google and Azure have had no discounts in the last 6 months. Have you noticed?
You know, that's true. Yes, I have. Yeah, there is. That's right. For a long time, it was a race to the bottom.
Mm. And then 2 months ago, Azure started increasing its prices. Mm. I'm beginning to wonder.
Didn't they start in Europe, I think, right?
Australia and Europe, yep. And they weren't small either. They were big. Now, part of that's to do with the American dollar getting a lot stronger. So, you know, perhaps they're just sitting on the American dollar. As the American dollar gets stronger, they're effectively getting a pay rise. But because they're all paid in US dollars, right?
Mm-hmm.
The flip side of this might be that there's a certain point at which scaling starts to become doubly expensive or exponentially more expensive as you make a shift, a gear change. So, for example, a while ago I heard Amazon was actually now designing its own electricity substations to make them more efficient because the ones that are... You know, think about that, right?
Amazon Electrons.
Because the current, you know, the ones that we have today are built for a different purpose. They're built to fail. If they go out, it might take 3 or 4 hours to get a team out there, and you know, if it takes a few weeks to fix it, well, that's fine. If you get a blowout and a big an oil cooled transformer, they take weeks to clean up because the oils that they use to cool them are toxic. So you have to bring in a cleanup crew, pull the toxic oil. You know, you ever looked around a transformer and seen them surrounded by gravel?
Yes.
That's because the gravel has to be taken away in case of a spill.
Uh-huh.
Because it's toxic. The oil that's in there is toxic. So that's also to do with water too, because then the water sinks away, so you don't actually get conductivity. A couple of things, but anyway, legacy of a long misspent youth. But, you know, once you start building your own power, you know, substations to bring power in, your costing is starting to change, because building
that's right.
those substations is expensive. It takes a long time, and now your research and development budget is getting even further out of control. You know, and if you start getting beyond 80,000 servers in a data center, I've heard, you know, Amazon was talking in their conference that I attended earlier this year, 80,000 is the magic number. Apparently, you can't really have one building with more than 80,000 servers. Well, if you keep scaling, you need to get more than 80,000 servers in a single building. Could that be a problem? So anyway, that's just one of the things is, you know, as these companies, maybe they're realizing just how hard it is to sustain clouds. The easy part is building them. The hard part is keeping them going.
I think in the early days of cloud computing, particularly around infrastructure as a service, there was a lot of issue around, is it safe? Is it secure? Can I be confident of my data? And I think that's where the service providers thought they could tell a good story as opposed to something like an Amazon. But those concerns, while they haven't disappeared, I think they've become less strong. And Amazon has demonstrated that, yes, it can be, you know, a business grade provider. And given Amazon's ability to be the margin player, that really hurts, I think, the service provider efforts here.
Hmm. Now, also keep in mind that Verizon Enterprise is basically an outsourcing arm. So there's managed security services, managed networks, managed IT. So they've got outsourcing contracts for a bunch of companies. That's also in this mix. But the big one is the cloud, I think, in this deal.
Well, this is probably a good time to take a break and talk about our sponsor, Riverbed. I'm sure you've heard of Riverbed. They do WAN optimization. They've been working to ensure application performance for more than 26,000 companies. They've got a platform that provides end-to-end visibility, optimization, and control across an entire enterprise. And Riverbed actually is going to be participating in an upcoming Packet Pushers podcast to talk about their new SD-WAN product. Greg, you've been involved in that, right?
Yes, Drew. Riverbed has been turning their WAN accelerator product, adding features to it, to do software-defined WAN. Now, we know that this is going on. It's a little bit early, but what they want to do is get out there and tell you that if you've got those Riverbed products or you're looking around in the SD-WAN product to add Riverbed to your list of things, currently it's called the Tiger Project, where they're taking their WAN acceleration technology, especially the application recognition piece, which is really key for the SD-WAN, that ability to identify applications.
Because then you can implement policy based on the applications.
Yep. And then, of course, you know that Riverbed's really very good with monitoring application performance inside of that. They've made some acquisitions of a few products in there. They've got the Wireshark engines inside of there. They can do things inside of that box which are critical to the SD-WAN functionality end-to-end. The actual part where you put it in a tunnel and send it from one side to the other is key, but it's at half the story. The other half is, I've got this application, it needs to meet this performance level. How much, you know, I need to make sure that it's doing that. And of course, Riverbed's got that capability. So you want to drop in on this conversation and hear about Project Tiger and how they're making that work and whether that's something that would suit your specific needs.
Yeah, so keep an eye out for that show and we'll definitely make sure you hear about it. So back to the news, Bluecoat, they acquired a cloud security startup called Elastica for $280 million. And I guess Elastica essentially is seeing what cloud services that your employees are using, and then you can say yes or no and maybe do a few other things.
It's definitely that, Drew, but I think it's also about the shift from non-real-time to real-time security. That is, threats can emerge in the internet faster than the time it takes to send out an update. So Bluecoat used to get a virus update once a day. Mm-hmm. When I was working on them a few years ago, now you've got to be doing that in real time. And what we've seen F5 do, for example, is buy a security cloud security company like this, which uses the internet as a data source and it looks for all the vulnerabilities. And then F5 says, we're going to send that down over the cloud, out of the cloud to your F5 as a firewall. And Bluecoat wants to be in that space after it was acquired by Thoma Bravo. So buying a cloud security startup gives them the ability to add cloud firewalling or that, you know, dynamic intelligence security in there.
That's right. And it's also, just to update it, they were taken private by Thoma Bravo and now they're owned by Bain Capital.
Yes.
So changing hands.
No doubt it's going to be emerged back into the market. Bain Capital won't hold on to it for long.
No. It doesn't do them any good.
It's also a cloud application, so it can run in the cloud itself. So you could, if you are going to have something in the far end of the cloud, that's going to be great. It's probably worth noting that Cisco bought something in this space just recently. They bought OpenDNS for the same reason, to get intelligence from the internet. And being sitting on everybody's DNS server gives you a vast amount of information, vast number of signals about what's happening on the internet and finding the bad people who are doing stuff with domain names, especially DNS shadow attacks.
And sticking with security news, A10 Networks, they just rolled out something called the Thunder Convergent Firewall. That's a great name, Thunder.
They really overdid it, didn't they? They really went in hard.
You can't overdo it with security. You got to go all
Thunder Convergent Firewall. They really went in hard. I mean, it's a great name. It's much better than the than some of the names we've had from other teams, like the 77255Z firewall.
That's right. Looks a lot better on a sell sheet.
A10, of course, is a load balancer solution. I believe we've had them on the show in the past. They have always been a software company, so extending their software is good to see. First of all, thing to note about a firewall is there's no official definition of a firewall. There's no one to bless your firewall, so anybody can make a firewall. Right? So it's important to understand that. So any product can be called a firewall as long as you're willing to stand up and call it a firewall. From a vendor point of view, the most important part about a firewall is you actually have to carry a certain amount of risk and then money on the balance sheet in case somebody sues you because there is no definition for a firewall. In other words, if the security fails, you might get stuffed. So what they've done is taken their software, added a secure web gateway with an explicit proxy. So just like F5, an explicit proxy that does URL filtering and SSL insight, so SSL termination, which gives you security policy around HTTP and SSL. They've got a high-performance gig or multi-gig firewall that does denial of service, so network denial of service and carrier-grade NAT, if that happens to be your particular torment. And it also has added in IPsec site-to-site VPN, which if you're building IPsec tunnels at the front of your network today, you've probably got a big routing problem where you've got a Cisco ASA or a Juniper of some sort over on there doing VPN. Why not just put it all in your load balancer and make a bigger single point of failure, which can be great. Of course, I would rather you bought multiple A10s, but it's a good way of doing things. And then finally, they're trying to promote it as a high-performance data center firewall where it has denial of service protection and server load balancing right down in the core of your network. I think this is a good move for A10. It builds on their existing product. The name's a bit, convergent firewall is sort of this thing that, if you do it all in the load balancer, my feeling is that you've got to be careful not to put too much in a single product because then it becomes very hard to upgrade that product or to change it. Every time you do something to the VPN, do you actually put the whole device at risk, for example? And those things can be issues. So do take a step back and think about having these in separate units, even though that does create some complexity around the routing, to make sure that you can consistently upgrade and keep these units up to date on a week-to-week, month-to-month basis.
All right. We're almost at the end of the show, but we have to have our usual tinfoil hat section, privacy section. I found this story from NBC News. Apparently, an organization, an advocacy group called Consumer Watchdog had applied to the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, to say, hey, there's the do not track setting on most web browsers. We'd love you to enforce that as an actual rule. Right now, it's only voluntary. You, as a consumer, can set the do not track preference, but the websites that you visit don't have to honor it. This group was advocating for, hey, let's get some stronger privacy protection in place, make this a law, and the FCC said, hey, we can't do that.
Yeah, that's not surprising, really.
I guess not.
I think the FCC
Maybe it's not in their charter. I'm not sure. I think if they wanted to, they could, but maybe the beating they took around the whole net neutrality debate, they're tired of it.
I don't think the FCC actually has any mandate for what's in the internet. They've got what is the internet. They're happy to regulate the network itself. Like, they have legislation which says this is what the networking companies have to deliver, and in return for which they get a monopoly in the market. All right, so there's a legal framework in which they can operate, which gives them a legal monopoly, especially in the US. However, what goes over the top of the internet is certainly outside of the FCC's mandate. The FCC can regulate radio frequencies and things like that and make sure that people who fly drones don't run into planes and, but in terms
little
of
things like that.
Yeah, but in terms of centering what actually works on the internet, I just don't think they've got a mandate for that. And quite honestly, this is a problem that we need to solve ourselves. Users need to rise up and say it's not acceptable for companies to just abuse our privacy. It's a privilege to have us as customers, and therefore you need to treat that privilege with respect, and that's not what's happening today. And so ad blocking, to me, as we see it now, everybody should be ad blocking simply to say we want a more respectful, better society built on respect for the customer, me, who is your privilege to have reading your content and to serve me ads. I'm happy to be served ads. I'm happy to see them. But right now, it's gone too far, out of control.
the trade-off of getting a lot of free services over the web was that advertising would support it. But we've gone way beyond advertising into tracking everything that you do everywhere that you go. A little too much. A couple more notes on this. Last week, we had talked about the Investigatory Powers Bill, which is being bandied about in the United Kingdom. And we were talking about how the UK wanted to essentially say you cannot implement unbreakable encryption if you're working in the UK. Apparently, they've pulled back on that. Mm. So that's a step forward. They've said, you know what? Okay, never mind. However, another story coming out of Ars Technica is saying, all right, we won't demand the encryption backdoors. However, we will demand backdoors into your software and equipment. And if anybody releases publicly that we've actually done this, they will go to jail.
This is still roaring around the British political system, and there's a lot of foo-for-ah in the UK. The press are having an absolute field day bashing up the government over this, and particularly the politician, Theresa May, the Home Secretary, who's pushing she's not a very pleasant person at the best of times, and it makes it doubly sweet for the press when they can beat up somebody they truly don't like. this idea of forcing ISPs to retain a record of your history is not new. Australia's been doing something similar. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest challenge here is that the ISPs will want to charge their customers to retain that data on behalf of the government.
Sure, those costs will get passed along.
Along with a substantial chance to raise prices and stick us all with an extra profit. If they were just going to pass on the cost, I'd probably be okay with it. But they're going to mark it up by 100,000% and just stitch us up, I think. Mm-hmm. They've been looking for a reason to increase prices and increase profit margins for a while, and this is a chance for them to do that. That's what I'm more concerned about.
So the fact that the government might just have a dedicated pipeline into the ISPs that they can go in and pluck any information they want at any time for any reason doesn't bother you?
At this point, you know, what are you going to do? I'm just sort of getting to the point where, you know, yes, it bothers me. No, they don't need it. But at the end of the day, it is the cheapest way for the government to conduct surveillance. And if you look at it in a certain way, like when they did network taps, like phone taps, that's exactly what they were doing, except there wasn't a year's history.
Right.
Yeah, right. So the challenge, of course, is that a web browsing history for a year is a vast amount of data for one person. And even if they do capture it, there's a whole bunch of things that aren't going to work. Like, what about data that goes through apps that doesn't use HTTP? Mm-hmm. Right? So if you're using the Facebook app, what's being recorded?
I don't know.
You can't, right? There's no URL there to tell you what you're looking at. So the vast amount of the data will actually be useless. So it's kind of stupid, eh?
It is kind of stupid.
I wrote a blog post on Ethereal Mind this week talking about why the governments want to do network surveillance. Ultimately, it's the cheapest way to do it. You know, surveilling the network is incredibly cheap. It's also cheap politics because you don't have to raise taxes to pay for storing of the data. And the third part is China does it.
That's right. We're falling behind. It's a surveillance gap.
Well, you know, China has basically, you know, the general belief that I have is that, and I'm not sure if it's right or wrong, but I'm going to go with it, is that China has, to some extent, co-opted its telecommunications network and the internet network to monitor its people. More importantly, it also co-ops Chinese companies to act as arms of the Chinese government. When they're operating overseas, they're expected to gather data, feed information back to the Communist Party and so forth. And to some extent, I think the Western governments are sort of looking at that model and going, you know what? That's a really cheap way of doing things.
They're jealous.
And you know what? We can always point the finger at China and blame them for doing it first. Nah, 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 nah.
That'll make us feel a lot better.
Yeah, so I have a sense that that's probably where they're headed. They're saying, well, China can do it, and we can get off the hook by just saying, because China can do it, so can we.
Well, I think the way they get off the hook is by saying, terrorism, terrorism.
Or
therefore, we must have all the data.
Terrorism, pedophiles.
All right. Last but not least, just a little technical update. Chrome, the Chrome browser from Google, is going to end support for Windows XP, Vista, and OS X 10. April 2016, so if you're out there using Chrome on one of those platforms, just a heads up.
Yeah, a lot of people, Internet Explorer ended support for certain crypto recently. Internet Explorer will die. A lot of people shifted to Firefox. Firefox is killing it off very soon. Chrome's announced that they're going to stop patching it on XP Vista and the previous versions of OS X very soon. So if you work in an enterprise that's used to just refreshing their desktop once every decade, you are fresh out of luck. You need to get on off your butt and start replacing them pretty much on a quarterly basis. And there's a whole point here about how fast the desktops are going to have to iterate in the years ahead. And
yes,
tablets are looking pretty sexy right about now.
All right, we'll keep that for the next issue. Thanks to our sponsor, Riverbed. Your work, your business, your productivity, they all depend on the performance of your applications. Let Riverbed accelerate your software-driven enterprise. And please stay tuned for a podcast with Riverbed coming up about their SD-WAN product. Greg, if folks haven't got enough of you today, where can they find more of you?
They can find me on my blog at etheriummind.com, on the Twitters is at etheriummind. I also hang around a bit in LinkedIn, but I find that place just way too creepy for words. Don't hesitate to get in touch.
All right, I'm Drew Connery Murray. You can follow me on Twitter at Drew_CM. And please check out our new newsletter, Link Propagation. You get a weekly dose of essential IT news, vendor announcements, and must-read blogs. You can find it at packetpushers.net/link-propagation. And if that's too much to remember, we also will have a link in the show notes. If you're out there listening on Facebook, please give us a like. You can visit us on LinkedIn. And please do leave a review on iTunes. As always, Network Break is powered by Virtual Donuts. And I'm proud to say that Virtual Donuts are announcing a partnership with Virtual Bagels. They're going to cross-sell, co-innovate, and the partnership is expected to generate over 1 billion calories by 2018.